could scare most anyone. He dressed all in green. His eyes were murky as muss, and he had green dreams. What Jojen dreamed came true.
Except he dreamed me dead, and I'm not.
Only he was, in a way. Jojen sent Hodor out for wood and built them a small fire, while Bran and Mira were cleaning the fish and frogs. They used Mira's helm for a cooking pot, chopping up the catch into little tubes and tossing in some water and some wild onions Hodor had found to make a froggy stew. It wasn't as good as deer, but it wasn't bad either, Bran decided as he ate.
"Thank you, Mira," he said. "My lady, you are most welcome, Your Grace."
"Come the morrow," Jojen announced. "We had best move on."
Bran could see Mira tense.
"Have you had a green dream?"
"No," he admitted.
"Why leave, then?" his sister demanded. "Tumbledown Tower is a good place for us. No villages near, the woods are full of game, there's fish and frogs in the streams and lakes, and who is ever going to find us here?"
"This is not the place we are meant to be."
"It is safe, though."
"It seems safe, I know," said Jojen, "but for how long?"
"There was a battle at Winterfell. We saw the dead.
Battles mean wars. If some army should take us unawares—"
"It might be Rob's army," said Bran. "Rob will come back from the south soon. I know he will. He'll come back with all his banners and chase the Iron Men away."
"Your maester said naught of Rob when he lay dying," Jojen reminded him. "Iron Men on the stony shore," he said, "and east the bastard of Bolton. Moat Cailin and Deepwood Mott fallen, the heir to Serwyn dead, and the castellan of Turin Square. War everywhere," he said, "each man against his neighbor."
"We have ploughed this field before," his sister said. "You want to make for the wall, and your three-eyed crow. That's well and good, but the wall is a very long way, and Bran has no legs but Hodor. If we were mounted—"
"If we were eagles, we might fly," said Jojen sharply. "But we have no wings, no more than we have horses."
"There are horses to be had," said Mira. "Even in the deep of the Wolfswood, there are foresters, crofters, hunters. Some will have horses."
"And if they do, should we steal them? Are we thieves? The last thing we need is men hunting us."
"We could buy them," she said. "Trade for them."
"Look at us, Mira. A crippled boy with a direwolf, a simple-minded giant, and two Crannog men 1,000 leagues from the neck. We will be known, and word will spread. So long as Bran remains dead, he is safe. Alive, he becomes prey for those who want him dead for good and true."
Jojen went to the fire to prod the embers with a stick.
"Somewhere to the north, the three-eyed crow awaits us. Bran has need of a teacher wiser than me."
"How, Jojen?" his sister asked. "How?"
"A foot," he answered. "A step at a time."
"The road from Greywater to Winterfell went on forever, and we were mounted then. You want us to travel a longer road on foot without even knowing where it ends? Beyond the wall, you say? I haven't been there no more than you. But I know that beyond the wall's a big place, Jojen. Are there many three-eyed crows or only one? How do we find him?"
"Perhaps he will find us."
Before Mira could find a reply to that, they heard the sound, the distant howl of a wolf drifting through the night.
"Summer?"
asked Jojen, listening. "No." Bran knew the voice of his direwolf.
"Are you certain?"
said the little grandfather. "Certain. Summer had wandered far afield today, and would not be back till dawn."
"Maybe Jojen dreams green, but he can't tell a wolf from a direwolf.
He wondered why they all listened to Jojen so much. He was not a prince like Bran, nor big and strong like Hodor, nor as good a hunter as Mira, yet somehow it was always Jojen telling them what to do. "We should steal horses, like Mira once," Bran said, "and ride to the Umbers, up at Last Hearth." He thought a moment. "Or we could steal a boat and sail down the White Knife to White Harbour Town. That fight Lord Manderly rules there. He was friendly at the Harvest Feast. He wanted to build ships. Maybe he built some, and we could sail to River Run and bring Rob home with all his army. Then it wouldn't matter who knew I was alive. Rob wouldn't let anyone hurt us."
"Hodor!" burped Hodor. "Hodor! Hodor!"
He was the only one who liked Bran's plan, though. Mira just smiled at him, and Jojen frowned. They never listened to what he wanted, even though Bran was a Stark and a prince besides, and the reeds of the neck were Stark bannermen.
"Hodor!" said Hodor, swaying. "Hodor! Hodor! 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 Hodor!"
Sometimes he liked to do this, just saying his name different ways, over and over and over. Other times he would stay so quiet you forgot he was there. There was never any knowing with Hodor.
"Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!"
he shouted. "He's not going to stop," Bran realized. "Hodor," he said, "why don't you go outside and train with your sword?" The stable boy had forgotten about his sword, but now he remembered.
"Hodor!"
he burped. He went for his blade. They had three tomb swords, taken from the crypts of Winterfell, where Bran and his brother Rickon had hidden from Theon Greyjoy's Iron Men. Bran claimed his uncle Brandon's sword, Mira, the one she found upon the knees of his grandfather, Lord Rickard. Hodor's blade was much older, a huge, heavy piece of iron, dull from centuries of neglect and well spotted with rust. He could swing it for hours at a time. There was a rotted tree near the tumblestones that he had hacked half to pieces. Even when he went outside, they could hear him through the walls, bellowing, "Hodor!" as he cut and slashed at his tree. Thankfully, the wolf's wood was huge, and there was not like to be anyone else around to hear.
"Jojen, what did you mean about a teacher?" Bran asked. "You're my teacher. I know I never marked the tree, but I will the next time. My third eye is open like you want it. So wide open that I fear you may fall through it and live all the rest of your days as a wolf of the woods."
"I won't, I promise. The boy promises. Will the wolf remember? You run with Summer. You hunt with him, kill with him. But you bend to his will more than him to yours."
"I just forget," Bran complained. "I'm only 9. I'll be better when I'm older. Even Florian the Fool and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight weren't great knights when they were 9.
"That is true," said Jojen, "and a wise thing to say if the days were still growing longer. But they aren't. You are a summer child, I know. Tell me the words of Al Stark."
"Winter is coming."
Just saying it made Bran feel cold. Jojen gave a solemn nod.
"I dreamed of a winged wolf bound to earth by chains of stone, and came to Winterfell to free him. The chains are off you now, yet still you do not fly."
"Then you teach me."
Bran still feared the three-eyed crow, who haunted his dreams sometimes, pecking endlessly at the skin between his eyes and telling him to fly.
"You're a green seer."
"No," said Jojen, "only a boy who dreams. The green seers were more than that. They were wargs as well as you are, and the greatest of them could wear the skins of any beast
that flies or swims or crawls, and could look through the eyes of the weirwoods as well, and see the truth that lies beneath the world. The gods give many gifts, Bran. My sister is a hunter. It is given to her to run swiftly, and stand so still she seems to vanish. She has sharp ears, keen eyes, a steady hand with net and spear. She can breathe mud and fly through trees. I could not do these things, no more than you could. To me the gods gave the green dreams, and to you, you could be more than me, Bran. You are the winged wolf, and there is no saying how far and high you might fly if you had someone to teach you. How can I help you master a gift I do not understand? We remember the first men in the Neck, and the children of the forest who were their friends, but so much is forgotten, and so much we never knew.
Mira took Bran by the hand.
If we stay here, troubling no one, you'll be safe until the war ends. You will not learn, though, except what my brother can teach you, and you've heard what he says. If we leave this place to seek refuge at Last Hearth or beyond the wall, we risk being taken. You're only a boy, I know, but you are our prince as well, our lord's son, and our king's true heir. We have sworn you our faith by earth and water, bronze and iron, ice and fire. The risk is yours, Bran, as is the gift. The choice should be yours too, I think. We are your servants to command.
She grinned.
At least in this.
You mean, Bran said, you'll do what I say? Truly?
Truly, my prince, the girl replied. So consider well.
Bran tried to think it through, the way his father might have. The great John's uncles, Hotha Horsebane and Moore's Crowfood, were fierce men. But he thought they would be loyal. And the Karstarks, them too. Carhold was a strong castle, father always said.
We would be safe with the Umbers or the Karstarks.
Or they could go south to fat Lord Manderley. At Winterfell he'd laughed a lot, and never seemed to look at Bran with so much pity as the other lords. Castle Serwyn was closer than White Harbour, but Maester Lewin had said that Clay Serwyn was dead. The Umbers and the Carstocks and the Manderleys may all be dead as well, he realized, as he would be if he was caught by the Iron Men or the Bastard of Bolton. If they stayed here, hidden down beneath Tumbledown Tower, no one would find them. He would stay alive. And crippled. Bran realized he was crying.
Stupid baby, he thought to himself.
No matter where he went, to Carhold, or White Harbour, or Greywater Watch, he'd be a cripple when he got there. He balled his hands into fists.
I want to fly, he told them. Please, take me to the Crow.
Davos. When he came up on deck, the long point of Driftmark was dwindling behind them, while Dragonstone rose from the sea ahead. A pale grey wisp of smoke blew from the top of the mountain to mark where the island lay.
Dragonmont is restless this morning, Davos thought, or else Melisandre is burning someone else.
Melisandre had been much in his thoughts, as Shayala's dance made her way across Blackwater Bay and through the gullet, tacking against perverse contrary winds. The great fire that burned atop the sharp point watchtower at the end of Massey's Hook reminded him of the ruby she wore at her throat, and when the world turned red at dawn and sunset, the drifting clouds turned the same color as the silks and satins of her rustling gowns. She would be waiting on Dragonstone as well, waiting in all her beauty and all her power, with her god and her shadows and his king. The Red Priestess had always seemed loyal to Stannis, until now.
She has broken him, as a man breaks a horse. She would ride him to power if she could, and for that she gave my sons to the fire. I will cut the living heart from her breast and see how it burns.
He touched the hilt of the fine long Lycene dirk that the captain had given him. The captain had been very kind to him. His name was Corain Sathmantes, a Lycene like Salador San, whose ship this was. He had the same pale blue eyes you often saw on Lyce, set in a bony, weather-worn face, but he had spent many years trading in the Seven Kingdoms. When he learned that the man he had plucked from the sea was the celebrated Onion Knight, he gave him the use of his own cabin and his own clothes, and a pair of new boots that almost fit. He insisted that Davos share his provisions as well, though that turned out badly. His stomach could not tolerate the snails and lampreys and other rich food Captain Corain so relished, and after his first meal at the captain's table, he spent the rest of the day with one end or the other dangling over the rail. Dragonstone loomed larger with every stroke of the oars. Davos could see the shape of the mountain now, and on its side the great black citadel with its gargoyles and dragon towers. The bronze figurehead at the bow of Shaeala's dance set up wings of salt spray as it cut the waves. He leaned his weight against the rail, grateful for its support. His ordeal had weakened him. If he stood too long, his leg shook, and sometimes he fell prey to uncontrollable fits of coughing and brought up gobs of bloody phlegm.
"There's nothing," he told himself. "Surely the gods did not bring me safe through fire and sea, only to kill me with a flux."
As he listened to the pounding of the oarmaster's drum, the thrum of the sail, and the rhythmic swish and creak of the oars, he thought back to his younger days, when these same sounds woke dread in his heart on many a misty morn. They heralded the approach of old Sir Tristraman's sea-watch, and the sea-watch was death to smugglers when Aerys Targaryen sat the Iron Throne.
"But that was another lifetime," he thought. "That was before the Onion Ship, before Storm's End, before Stannis shortened my fingers. That was before the war, or the Red Comet, before I was a Seaworth, or a knight. I was a different man in those days, before Lord Stannis raised me high."
Captain Corain had told him of the end of Stannis's hopes. On the night, the river burned. The Lannisters had taken him from the flank, and his fickle bannermen had abandoned him by the hundreds in the hour of his greatest need.
"King Renly's shade was seen as well," the captain said, "slaying right and left as he led the Lion Lord's van. It said his green armour took a ghostly glow from the wildfire, and his antlers ran with golden flames." Renly Shade!
Davos wondered if his sons would return as shades as well. He had seen too many queer things on the sea to say that ghosts did not exist.
"Did none keep faith?"
he asked.
"Some few," the captain said. "The queen's kin, them in chief. We took off many who wore the fox and flowers, though many more were left ashore with all manner of badges. Lord Florent is the king's hand on Dragonstone now."
The mountain grew taller, crowned all in pale smoke. The sail sang, the drum beat, the oars pulled smoothly, and before very long the mouth of the harbour opened before them.
"So empty," Davos thought, remembering how it had been before, with the ships crowding every quay and rocking at anchor off the breakwater.
He could see Salador San's flagship Valerian moored at the quay, where Fury and her sisters had once tied up. The ships on either side of her had striped Lycene hulls as well. In vain he looked for any sign of Lady Maria or Wraith. They pulled down the sail as they entered the harbour, to dock on oars alone. The captain came to Davos as they were tying up.
"My prince will wish to see you at once."
A fit of coughing seized Davos as he tried to answer. He clutched the rail for support and spat over the side.
"The king!" he wheezed. "I must go to the king. For where the king is, I will find Melisande."
"No one goes to the king," Corain Sathmantes replied firmly.
"A Salador's son will tell you. Him first."
Davos was too weak to defy him. He could only nod. Salador San was not aboard his Valerian. They found him at another quay, a quarter mile distant, down in the hold of a big-bellied Pentoshi cog named Bountiful Harvest, counting cargo with two eunuchs. One held a lantern, the other a wax tablet and stylus.
37, 38, 39...
the old rogue was saying when Davos and the captain came down the hatch. Today he wore a wine-coloured tunic and high boots of bleached white leather inlaid with silver scrollwork. Pulling the stopper from a jar, he sniffed, sneezed, and said,
"A coarse grind, and of the second quality, my nose declares. The bill of lading is saying 43 jars, eh? Where have the others gotten to? I am wondering. These Pentoshi, do they think I am not counting, eh?"
When he saw Davos, he stopped suddenly.
"Is it pepper stinging my eyes, or tears? Is that the knight of the onions who stands before me? No, how can it be? My dear friend Davos died on the burning river, all agree. Why has he come to haunt me?" "I'm no ghost, Salah." "What else? My onion knight was never so thin or so pale as you."
Salador San threaded his way between the jars of spice and bolts of cloth that filled the hole of the merchanter, wrapped Davos in a fierce embrace, then kissed him once on each cheek and a third time on his forehead.
"You are still warm, sir, and I feel your heart thumpity-thumping. Can it be true, The sea that swallowed you has spit you up again?"
Davos was reminded of Patchface, Princess Shireen's lackwit fool. He had gone into the sea as well, and when he came out, he was mad.
"Am I mad as well?"
He coughed into a gloved hand and said,
"I swam beneath a chain and washed ashore on a spear of the Merlin King. I would have died there if Shehala's dance had not come upon me."
Salador San threw an arm around the captain's shoulder.
"This was well done, Corain. You will be having a fine reward, I am thinking. Maizomar, be a good eunuch, eh, and take my friend Davos to the honor's cabin. Fetch him some hot wine with cloves. I am misliking the sound of that cough. Squeeze some lime in it as well, and bring white cheese and a bowl of those cracked green olives we counted earlier. Davos, I will join you soon, once I have bespoken our good captain. You will be forgiving me, eh, I know. You do not eat all the olives, or I must be cross with you."
Davos let the elder of the two eunuchs escort him to a large and lavishly furnished cabin at the stern of the ship. The carpets were deep, the windows stained glass, and any of the great leather chairs would have seated three of Davos quite comfortably. The cheese and olives arrived shortly, and a cup of steaming hot red wine. He held it between his hands and sipped it gratefully. The warmth felt soothing as it spread through his chest. Salador San appeared not long after.
"You must be forgiving me for the wine, my friend. These Pentoshi would drink their own water if it were purple." "It will help my chest," said Davos. "Hot wine is better than a compress, my mother used to say. You shall be needing compresses as well, I am thinking. Sitting on a spear all this long time, eh? Oh, my! How are you finding that excellent chair? He has fat cheeks, eh? Does he not?"
"Who?" asked Davos between sips of hot wine.
"Illyrio Mopatis A whale with whiskers. I am telling you truly, these chairs were built to his measure, though he is seldom bestirring himself from Pentas to sit in them. A fat man always sits comfortably, eh? I'm thinking. For he carries his pillow with him wherever he goes, eh? How is it you come by a Pentashi ship? Asked Davos. Have you gone pirate again, my lord? He set his empty cup aside. Vile calumny! Who has suffered more from pirates than Salador San? I ask only what is due to me. Much gold is owed, oh yes, but I am not without reason, eh? So, in place of coin, I have taken a handsome parchment, very crisp. It bears the name and seal of Lord Alistair Florent, the hand of the king. I am made Lord of Blackwater Bay, and no vessel may be crossing my lordly waters without my lordly leave. No? And when these outlaws are trying to steal past me in the night to avoid my lawful duties and customs, why, they are no better than smugglers, eh? So I am well within my rights to seize them. The old pirate laughed. I cut off no man's fingers, though. What good are bits of fingers? The ships I am taking, the cargoes, a few ransoms, nothing unreasonable. He gave Davos a sharp look. You are unwell, my friend, eh? That cough, and so thin. I am seeing your bones through your skin, and yet I am not seeing your little bag of finger bones.
Old habit made Davos reach for the leather pouch that was no longer there.
I lost her in the river. My luck. Oh, the river was terrible, Salador San said solemnly. Even from the bay I was seeing and shuddering. Davos coughed, spat, and coughed again. I saw Black Brother burning, and Fury as well, he finally managed hoarsely. Did none of our ships escape the fire?
Part of him still hoped.
Lord Stefan, Ragged Jenner, Swift Sword, Laughing Lord, and some others were upstream of the Pyromancer's Pissing, yes. They did not burn, but with the chain raised, neither could they be flying. Some few were surrendering, eh? Most rode far up the black water, away from the battling, and then were sunk by their crews, so they would not be falling into Lannister hands, eh? Ragged Jenner and Laughing Lord are still playing pirate on the river, I have heard, but who can say if it is so, eh?
Lady Maria? Davos asked.
Wraith?
Salador San put a hand on Davos's forearm and gave a squeeze.
No, of them, no. I am sorry, my friend. They were good men, your Dale and Allard, but this comfort I can give you. Your young Devon was among those we took off at the end. The brave boy never once left the king's side, or so they say.
For a moment he felt almost dizzy. His relief was so palpable. He had been afraid to ask about Devon.
The mother is merciful. I must go to him, Salar. I must see him. Yes, said Salador San, and you will be wanting to sail to Cape Wrath, I know, to see your wife and your two little ones, eh? You must be having a new ship, I am thinking. His Grace will give me a ship, said Davos.
The Lycini shook his head.
Of ships His Grace has none, but Salador San has many, eh? The king's ships burned up on the river, but not mine. You shall have one, old friend. You will sail for me, yes. You will dance into Bravas and Myrrh and Valentis in the black of night, all unseen, and dance out again with silks and spices. We will be having fat purses, yes? You are kind, Salar, but my duty is to my king, not your purse. The war will go on. Stannis is still the rightful heir by all the laws of the Seven Kingdoms. All the laws are not helping when all the ships burn up, I am thinking. And your king, well, you will be finding him changed, I am fearing. Since the battle, he sees no one, but broods in his stone drum. Queen Celeste keeps court for him, with her uncle, the Lord Alistair, who is naming himself the Hand. The king's seal she has given to this uncle to fix to the letters he writes, even to my pretty parchment. But it is a little kingdom they are ruling, poor and rocky, yes? There is no gold, not even a little bit, to pay faithful Salador San what is owed him, and only those knights that we took off at the end, and no ships, but my little brave few, eh?
A sudden racking cough bent Davos over. Salador San moved to help him, but he waved him off, and after a moment he recovered.
No one? He wheezed. What do you mean? He sees no one.
His voice sounded wet and thick even in his own ears, and for a moment the cabin swam dizzily around him.
No one but her,
said Salador San, and Davos did not have to ask who he meant.
My friend, you tire yourself. It is a bed you are needing, not Salador San. A bed and many blankets with a hot compress for your chest and more wine and cloves.
Davos shook his head.
I will be fine. Tell me, Salar, I must know. No one but Melisandre?
The Lysenae gave him a long, doubtful look, and continued reluctantly.
The guards keep all others away, even his queen and his little daughter. Servants bring meals that no one eats.
He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
Queer talking I have heard of hungry fires within the mountain, and how Stannis and a red woman go down together to watch the flames, eh? There are shafts, they say, and secret stairs down into the mountain's heart, into odd places where only she may walk unburned. It is enough, and more, to give an old man such terrors that sometimes he can scarcely find the strength to eat. Melisandre, Davos shivered. The Red Woman did this to him, he said. She sent the fire to consume us, to punish Stannis for setting her aside, to teach him that he could not hope to win without her sorceries.
The Lysenae chose a plump olive from the bowl between them.
You are not the first to be saying this, my friend, but if I am you, I am not saying it so loudly, eh? Dragonstone crawls with these queen's men, oh yes, and they have sharp ears and sharper knives.
He popped the olive into his mouth.
I have a knife myself. Captain Corain made me a gift of it.
He pulled out the dirk and laid it on the table between them.
A knife to cut out Melisandre's heart, if she has one.
Salador San spit out an olive pit.
Davos, good Davos, you must not be saying such things, even in jest. No jest. I mean to kill her. If she can be killed by mortal weapons.
Davos was not certain that she could. He had seen old Maester Cresson slip poison into her wine. With his own eyes he had seen it. But when they both drank from the poison cup, it was a maester who died, not the Red Priestess.
A knife through the heart, though. Even demons can be killed by cold iron, the singers say. These are dangerous talkings, my friend.
Salador San warned him.
I am thinking you are still sick from the sea. The fever has cooked your wits, yes? Best you are taking to your bed for a long resting until you are stronger. Until my resolve weakens, you mean?
Davos got to his feet. He did feel feverish and a little dizzy, but it did not matter.
You are a treacherous old rogue, Salador San, but a good friend all the same.
Lysenae stroked his pointed silver beard.
So, with this great friend you will be staying, yes? No, I will be going. He coughed. Go, look at you. You cough, you tremble, you are thin and weak. Where will you be going? To the castle. My bed is there, and my son.
And the Red Woman?
Salador-san said suspiciously.
She is in the castle also.
Ertu.
Davos slid the dirk back into its sheath.
You are an onion smuggler. What do you know of skulkings and stabbings? And you are ill. You cannot even hold the dirk. Do you know what will happen to you if you are caught? While we were burning on the river, the queen was burning traitors. Servants of the dark, she named them, poor men. And the Red Woman sang as the fires were lit.
Davos was unsurprised.
I knew, he thought, I knew, before he told me.
She took Lord Sunglass from the dungeons, he guessed, and Hubbard Rampton's sons.
Just so, and burn them, as she will burn you. If you kill the Red Woman, they will burn you for revenge. And if you fail to kill her, they will burn you for the trying. She will sing, and you will scream, and then you will die. And you have only just come back to life.
And this is why, said Davos, to do this thing, to make an end of Melisande of Achaye and all her works. Why else would the sea have spit me out? You know Blackwater Bay as well as I do, Seller. No sensible captain would ever take his ship through the spears of the Merlin King and risk ripping out his bottom. Shayala's dance should never have come near me.
A wind, eh?
Insisted Salador-san loudly.
An ill wind is all. A wind drove her too far to the south.
And who set the wind?
Salar, the mother spoke to me.
The old Iceni blinked at him.
Your mother is dead.
The mother! She blessed me with 7 sons, and yet I let them burn her. She spoke to me. We call the fire, she said. We call the shadows, too. I rode Melisande into the bowels of Storm's End and watched her birth a horror.
He saw it still in his nightmares, the gaunt black hands pushing against her thighs as it wriggled free of her swollen womb.
She killed Cressin and Lord Renly and a brave man named Courtney Penrose, and she killed my sons as well. Now it is time someone killed her.
Someone, said Salador-san. Yes, just so, someone, but not you. You are weak as a child and no warrior. Stay, I beg you, we will talk more and you will eat, and perhaps we will sail to Braavos and hire a faceless man to do this thing, yes? But you, no, you must sit and eat. He is making this much harder,
thought Davos wearily,
and it was perishingly hard to begin with. I have a vengeance in my belly, Salla. It leaves no room for food. Let me go now, for our friendship, wish me luck, and let me go.
Salador-san pushed himself to his feet.
You are no true friend, I am thinking. When you are dead, who will be bringing your ashes and bones back to your lady wife, eh? And telling her that she has lost a husband and 4 sons. Only sad old Salador-san. But so be it, brave Sir Knight. Go rushing to your grave. I will gather your bones in a sack and bring them to the sons you leave behind to wear in little bags around their necks, eh?
He waved an angry hand with rings on every finger.
Go! Go, 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 go!
Davos did not want to leave like this.
Salar, go! Or stay better, but if you are going, go!
He went. His walk up from the bountiful harvest to the gates of Dragonstone was long and lonely. The dockside streets where soldiers and sailors and small folk had thronged were empty and deserted. Where once he had stepped around squealing pigs and naked children, rats scurried. His legs felt like pudding beneath him, and thrice the coughing racked him so badly that he had to stop and rest. No one came to help him, nor even peered through a window to see what was the matter. The windows were shuttered, the doors barred, and more than half the houses displayed some mark of mourning.
Thousands sailed up the Blackwater Rush, and hundreds came back, Davos reflected. My sons did not die alone. May the mother have mercy on them all.
When he reached the castle gates, he found them shot as well. Davos pounded on the iron-studded wood with his fist. When there was no answer, he kicked at it again and again. Finally, a crossbowman appeared atop the barbican, peering down between two towering gargoyles.
"Who goes there?"
He craned his head back and cupped his hands around his mouth.
"Sir Davos Seaworth, to see his grace." "Are you drunk? Go away and stop that bounding."
Salador San had warned him. Davos tried a different tack.
"Send for my son, then, Devon, the king's squire."
The guard frowned.
"Who did you say you were?"
"Davos,"
he shouted,
"the Onion Knight."
The head vanished to return a moment later.
"Be off with you. The Onion Knight died on the river. His ship burned."
"His ship burned," Davos agreed. "But he lived, and here he stands. Is Jait still captain of the gate?"
"Who?"
"Jait, Blackberry. He knows me well enough."
"I never heard of him. Most like he's dead."
"Lord Chittering, then."
"Oh, that one, I know. He burned on the Blackwater."
"Hookface Will, Hal the Hug?"
"Dead and dead,"
the crossbowman said, but his face betrayed a sudden doubt.
"You wait there."
He vanished again. Davos waited.
"Gone. All gone," he thought dully, remembering how Fat Hal's white belly always showed beneath his grease-stained doublet, the long scar the fishhook had left across Will's face, the way Jait always doffed his cap at the women, be they 5 or 50, high-born or low.
"Drowned or burned, with my sons and 1,000 others, gone to make a king in hell."
Suddenly the crossbowman was back.
"Go round to the sally port, and they'll admit you."
Davos did as he was bid. The guards who ushered him inside were strangers to him. They carried spears, and on their breasts they wore the fox and flowers sigil of House Florent. They escorted him not to the stone drum, as he'd expected, but under the arch of the dragon's tail and down to Aegon's garden.
"Wait here," the sergeant told him. "Does his grace know that I've returned?" asked Davos.
"Bugger all if I know. Wait," I said.
The man left, taking his spearman with him. Aegon's garden had a pleasant piney smell to it, and tall dark trees rose on every side. There were wild roses as well, and towering thorny hedges, and a boggy spot where cranberries grew.
"Why have they brought me here?" Davos wondered.
Then he heard a faint ringing of bells, and a child's giggle, and suddenly the fool, Patchface, popped from the bushes, shambling along as fast as he could go, with Princess Shireen hot on his heels.
"You come back now!"
she was shouting after him.
"Patches, you come back!"
When the fool saw Davos, he jerked to a sudden halt, the bells on his antlered tin helmet going ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling. Hopping from one foot to the other, he sang,
"Fool's blood, king's blood, blood on the maidens, aye, but chains for the guests and chains for the bridegroom, aye, aye, aye."
Shireen almost caught him then, but at the last instant he hopped over a patch of bracken and vanished among the trees. The princess was right behind him. The sight of them made Davos smile. He had turned a cuff into his gloved hand when another small shape crashed out of the hedge and bowled right into him, knocking him off his feet. The boy went down as well, but he was up again almost at once.
"What are you doing here?"
he demanded, as he brushed himself off. Jet-black hair fell to his collar, and his eyes were a startling blue. "You shouldn't get in my way when I'm running."
"No," Davis agreed, "I shouldn't."
Another fit of coughing seized him as he struggled to his feet. "Are you unwell?" The boy took him by the arm and pulled him to his feet. "Should I summon the maester?" Davis shook his head.
"A cough. It will pass."
The boy took him in his word. "We were playing monsters and maidens," he explained.
"I was the monster. It's a childish game, but my cousin likes it. Do you have a name?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
The boy looked him up and down dubiously.
"Are you certain? You don't look very knightly."
"I am the Knight of the Onions, my lord."
The blue eyes blinked.
"The one with the black ship?"
"You know the tale?"
"You brought my uncle Stannis fish to eat before I was born, when Lord Tyrell had him under siege."
The boy drew himself up tall.
"I am Edric Storm," he announced, "King Robert's son."
"Of course you are."
Davis had known that almost at once. The lad had the prominent ears of a Florent, but the hair, the eyes, the jaw, the cheekbones, those were all Baratheon.
"Did you know my father?" Edric Storm demanded.
"I saw him many a time, while calling on your uncle at court, but we never spoke."
"My father taught me to fight," the boy said proudly. "He came to see me almost every year, and sometimes we trained together. On my last name day, he sent me a warhammer just like his, only smaller. They made me leave it at Storm's End, though. Is it true my Uncle Stannis cut off your fingers?"
"Only the last joint. I still have fingers, only shorter."
"Show me."
Davis peeled his glove off. The boy studied his hand carefully.
"It did not shorten your thumb?"
"No," Davis coughed. "No, he left me that."
"He should not have chopped any of your fingers," the lad decided. "That was ill done."
"I was a smuggler."
"Yes, but you smuggled him fish and onions."
"Lord Stannis knighted me for the onions and took my fingers for the smuggling."
He pulled his glove back on.
"My father would not have chopped your fingers."
"As you say, my lord." "Robert was a different man than Stannis, true enough. The boy is like him, aye, and like Renly as well."
That thought made him anxious. The boy was about to say something more when they heard steps. Davis turned. Sir Axel Florent was coming down the garden path with a dozen guards in quilted jerkins. On their breasts they wore the fiery heart of the Lord of Light.
"Queen's men," Davis thought.
A cough came on him suddenly. Sir Axel was short and muscular, with a barrel chest, thick arms, bandy legs, and hair growing from his ears. The Queen's uncle, he had served as Castellan of Dragonstone for a decade, and had always treated Davis courteously, knowing he enjoyed the favour of Lord Stannis. But there was neither courtesy nor warmth in his tone as he said,
"Sir Davis, an undrowned. How can that be?" "Onions float, sir. Have you come to take me to the king?"
"I've come to take you
to the dungeon."
Sir Axel waved his men forward.
"Seize him, and take his dirk. He means to use it on our lady."
Jamie. Jamie was the first to spy the inn. The main building hugged the south shore where the river bent, its long low wings outstretched along the water as if to embrace travellers sailing downstream. The lower story was grey stone, the upper whitewashed wood, the roof slate. He could see stables as well, and an arbour heavy with vines. "No smoke from the chimneys," he pointed out as they approached, "nor lights in the windows."
"The inn was still open when last I passed this way," said Sir Cleos Frey. "They brewed a fine ale. Perhaps there's still some to be had in the cellars."
"There may be people," Brian said, "hiding or dead."
"Frightened of a few corpses, wench," Jamie said. She glared at him.
My name is Brian, yes.
Wouldn't you like to sleep in a bed for a night, Brian? We'd be safer than on the open river, and it might be prudent to find what's happened here. She gave no answer, but after a moment she pushed at the tiller to angle the skiff in toward the weathered wooden dock. Sir Cleos scrambled to take down the sail. When they bumped softly against the pier, he climbed out to tie them up. Jamie clambered after him, made awkward by his chains. At the end of the dock, a flaking shingle swung from an iron post, painted with the likeness of a king upon his knees, his hands pressed together in a gesture of fealty. Jamie took one look and laughed aloud.
We could not have found a better inn.
Is this some special place?
The wench asked suspiciously.
Sir Cleos answered, This is the inn of the Kneeling Man, my lady. It stands upon the very spot where the last king in the north knelt before Aegon the Conqueror to offer his submission. That's him on the sign, I suppose.
Torrhen had brought his power south after the fall of the two kings on the Field of Fire, said Jamie. But when he saw Aegon's dragon and the size of his host, he chose a path of wisdom and bent his frozen knees. He stopped at the sound of a horse's whinny.
Horses in the stable. One, at least. And one is all I need to put the wench behind me.
Let's see who's home, shall we?
Without waiting for an answer, Jamie went clinking down the dock, put a shoulder to the door, shoved it open, and found himself eye to eye with a loaded crossbow. Standing behind it was a chunky boy of 15.
Lion, fish, or wolf?
The lad demanded.
We were hoping for capon.
Jamie heard his companions entering behind him. The crossbow is a coward's weapon.
It'll put a bolt through your heart all the same.
Perhaps, but before you can wind it again, my cousin here will spill your entrails on the floor.
Don't be scaring the lad now, Sir Cleos said. We mean no harm, the wench said, and we have coin to pay for food and drink.
She dug a silver piece from her pouch. The boy looked suspiciously at the coin, and then at Jamie's manacles.
Why is this one in irons?
Killed some crossbowman, said Jamie.
Do you have ale?
Yes,
the boy lowered the crossbow an inch.
Undo your sword belts and let them fall, and might be we'll feed you.
He edged around to peer through the thick, diamond-shaped window panes and see if any more of them were outside.
That's a tully sail. We come from River Run,
Brian undid the clasp on her belt and let it clatter to the floor. Sir Cleos followed suit. A sallow man with a pucked, doughy face stepped through the cellar door, holding a butcher's heavy cleaver.
See, aye, we got horse meat enough for three. The horse was old and duff, but the meat's still fresh.
Is there bread? Asked Brian.
Hard bread and stale oat cakes.
Jamie grinned.
Now, there's an honest innkeep. They all serve you stale bread and stringy meat, but most don't own up to it so freely.
I'm no innkeep. I buried him out back with his women.
Did you kill them?
Would I tell you if I did?
The man spat.
Likely it were wolves' work, or maybe lions. What's the difference? The wife and I found them dead. The way we see it, this place is ours now.
Where is this wife of yours? Sir Cleos asked. The man gave him a suspicious squint.
And why will you be wanting to know that? She's not here. No more than you three will be, unless I like the taste of your silver.
Brian tossed the coin to him. He caught it in the air, bit it, and tucked it away.
She's got more,
the boy with the crossbow announced.
So she does, boy. Go down and find me some onions.
The lad raised the crossbow to his shoulder, gave them one last sullen look, and vanished into the cellar.
Your son? Sir Cleos asked. Just a boy the wife and me took in. We had two sons, but the lions killed one,
and the other died of the flux. The boy lost his mother to the bloody mummers. These days a man needs someone to keep watch while he sleeps."
He waved the cleaver at the tables.
"Might as well sit."
The hearth was cold, but Jamie picked the chair nearest the ashes and stretched out his long legs under the table. The clink of his chains accompanied his every movement. "An irritating sound. Before this is done, I'll wrap these chains around that wench's throat. See how she likes them then." The man, who wasn't an innkeep, charred 3 huge horse steaks and fried the onions in bacon grease, which almost made up for the stale oatcakes. Jamie and Cleos drank ale, Brian a cup of cider. The boy kept his distance, perching atop the cider barrel with his crossbow across his knees, cocked and loaded. The cook drew a tankard of ale and sat with them.
"What news from Riverrun?"
he asked Sir Cleos, taking him for their leader. Sir Cleos glanced at Brian before answering.
"Lord Hoster is failing, but his son holds the fords of the Red Fork against the Lannisters. There have been battles."
"Battles everywhere. Where are you bound, sir?"
"King's Landing."
Sir Cleos wiped grease off his lips. Their host snorted.
"Then you're 3 fools. Last I heard, King Stannis was outside the city walls. They say he has 100,000 men and a magic sword."
Jamie's hands wrapped around the chain that bound his wrists, and he twisted it taut, wishing for the strength to snap it in two. "Then I'd show Stannis where to sheathe his magic sword."
"I'd stay well clear of Black King's Road if I were you,"
the man went on.
"It's worse than bad, I hear. Wolves and lions both, and bands of broken men preying on anyone they can catch."
"Vermin," declared Sir Cleos with contempt. "Such would never dare to trouble armed men."
"Begging your pardon, sir, but I see one armed man travelling with a woman and a prisoner in chains."
Brian gave the cook a dark look. "The wench does hate being reminded that she's a wench," Jamie reflected, twisting at the chains again. The links were cold and hard against his flesh, the iron implacable. The manacles had chafed his wrists raw.
"I mean to follow the trident to the sea," the wench told their host. "We'll find mounts at Maidenpool and ride by way of Duskendale and Rusby. That should keep us well away from the worst of the fighting."
Their host shook his head.
"You'll never reach Maidenpool by river. Not 30 miles from here, a couple of boats burned and sank, and the channel's been silting up around them. There's a nest of outlaws there, preying on anyone tries to come by, and more of the same downriver, around the Skipping Stones and Red Deer Island. And the Lightning Lord's been seen in these parts as well. He crosses the river wherever he likes, riding this way and that way, never still."
"And who is this Lightning Lord?" demanded Sir Cleos Frey.
"Lord Beric, as it please you, sir. They call him that 'cause he strikes so sudden, like lightning from a clear sky. It's said he cannot die."
"They all die when you shove a sword through them," Jamie thought. "Does Thoros of Myr still ride with him?"
"Aye, the Red Wizard. I've heard tell he has strange powers."
"Well, he had the power to match Robert Baratheon drink for drink, and there were few enough who could say that." Jamie had once heard Thoros tell the king that he became a red priest because the robes hid the wine stain so well. Robert had laughed so hard he'd spit ale all over Cersei's silken mantle. "Far be it from me to make objection," he said, "but perhaps the trident is not our safest course."
"I'd say that's so,"
the cook agreed.
even if you get past Red Deer Island and don't meet up with Lord Beric and the Red Wizard, there's still the Ruby Ford before you. Last I heard, it was the Leech Lord's wolves held the ford, but that was some time past. By now, it could be lions again.